Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now covering 1 Kings chapter 18, verses 20 through 46. In this section, Elijah will meet the prophets of Baal and defeat them on Mount Carmel. Our context is this. In the first part of chapter 18, Elijah had confronted Ahab with his idolatry, told him it wasn't going to rain for 3.5 years, and he set up the contest. He challenged Ahab to the contest, and Ahab agreed to it, and so here we are. Ahab ruled between 874 BC and 853 BC, so that gives us our time frame. Before we begin in verse 20, we might ask, why did Ahab consent to the contest? As I mentioned in the last audio, he might have actually thought Baal was greater than Yahweh and thought he was going to beat Elijah. Or he might have thought, well, even if Yahweh beats Baal, at least Yahweh is going to say, okay, I win, so I'm going to give you some rain. And remember, Ahab was publicly challenged. It looks bad to back down when a prophet comes up and says, my God's bigger than your God, Ahab. What you going to do about it? So Ahab consents. We now start in 1 Kings 18, verses 20 and 21. So Ahab sent word throughout all Israel and assembled the prophets on Mount Carmel. Elijah went before the people and said, how long will you waver between two opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal is God, follow him. But the people said nothing. Now the prophets that were assembled by Ahab were only the prophets of Baal. There were 450 of those. Remember, there was also 400 prophets of Asherah, the female pagan goddess, Asherah slash Astarte slash Ashtoreth. She went by different names, but they didn't show up. Only the 450 prophets of Baal. Now, why didn't the prophets of Asherah, Jezebel's prophets, why didn't they show up? She was the one that maintained them and fed them. The commentator Poole suggests that perhaps Jezebel didn't let her prophets go because she feared that they would get beat and she didn't want to be publicly shamed. Maybe the prophets themselves feared the outcome. Maybe they feared that they would lose. And then if they failed, Jezebel's attitude toward them might not be pleasant. She might try to kill them. They were living fat and happy at Jezebel's table now. Why risk a good thing? But at any rate, that's speculation. They didn't show up, but 450 prophets of Baal did. Now, the scene of the battle is Mount Carmel. Now, I've got a couple of interesting quotes about Mount Carmel to give you a feeling for what the scenery was like. Jameson, Foss, and Brown say that, quote, Mount Carmel was, quote, a bold, bluff promontory, which extends from the western coast of Palestine at the Bay of Acre for many miles eastward to the central hills of Samaria. It is a long range, presenting many summits and intersected by a number of small ravines. The spot where the contest took place is situated at the eastern extremity, which is also the highest point of the whole ridge. It is called El Moraka, the burning, or, quote, the burnt place. No spot could have been better adapted for the thousands of Israel to have stood drawn up on those gentle slopes. By the way, that name El Moraka, the burning, I'm sure is referring to the fact that Elijah called down fire and burnt up the sacrifice there, the burning. So no spot could have been better adapted for the thousands of Israel to have stood drawn up on those gentle slopes. The rock shoots up in an almost perpendicular wall of more than 200 feet in height on the side of the Vale of Esdraelon. That's the Jezreel Valley, the Esdraelon Valley. That valley, by the way, runs from the northwest to the southeast from the Mediterranean Sea all the way down to the Jordan River. And Mount Carmel is just to the south of it. So if you stand, I've been there. You stand on Mount Carmel and look over the Esdraelon Valley, you can see for miles and miles and miles. And it is. It's a perpendicular wall. It's just straight up in the air. The Mount Carmel and its ranges are so steep there. This wall that ran down to the Esdraelon Valley, says Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, this wall made it visible over the whole plain, made Mount Carmel visible. And from all surrounding heights where gazing multitudes would be stationed. So in other words, all through these ranges of hills there in Mount Carmel, people could stand and they could see this battle going on between Yahweh and the prophets of Baal. Another quotation from Jameson, Fawcett, Brown, quote, the natural features of the mount exactly correspond with the details of this narrative. The conspicuous summit, 1,635 feet above the sea, on which the altars were placed, presents an esplanade spacious enough for the king and the priest of Baal to stand on the one side and Elijah on the other. It is a rocky soil on which there is an abundance of loose stones to furnish the 12 stones of which the altar was built. a bed of thick earth in which a trench could be dug, and yet the earth not so loose that the water poured into it would be absorbed. 250 feet beneath the altar plateau, there is a perennial fountain, which, being close to the altar of the Lord, might not have been accessible to the people, and whence, therefore, even in that season of severe drought, Elijah could procure those copious supplies of water which he poured over the altar. I don't know why the people couldn't get to that spring and Elijah could, but we move on. The distance between this spring and the site of the altar is so short as to make it perfectly possible to go thrice thither and back again, whereas it would have been impossible once in an afternoon to fetch water from the sea. The summit is 1,000 feet above the Kishon. That's the Kishon River, which runs down the valley of Esdraelon, the Jezreel Valley. The summit is 1,000 feet above the Kishon, which nowhere runs from the sea so close to the base of the mount as just beneath El Moraka, so that the priest of Baal could in a few minutes be taken down to the brook and slain there, as we'll see in just a minute. Now, Elijah stands before the people and publicly asks them, how long will you waver between two opinions, Yahweh on one hand, Baal on the other? Well, that's a very famous quotation of Elijah. It's quoted all the time in sermons. The application is obvious. It's interesting that the Hebrew idiom, which is translated here, waver, is hop between two boughs. In other words, you've seen birds. I live in the country. I've seen birds do this. They'll get on one bough of a tree, then they'll hop to another bough of a tree. Then they'll hop back to the same bough of the tree. They'll hop back and forth. It shows indecision, indecisiveness. So the people were not being decisive, and Elijah is calling them to repentance and submission to Yahweh. But the people said nothing. Now, why did they not answer Elijah? Well, it could be they were convicted of their sin of worshiping Baal and they were ashamed. It could be they were confused about what was going on. I think most likely they feared a trap. They would either offend a king or a prophet no matter how they answered. If they answered, we are following Baal, then they're going to offend Elijah, a prophet of God. Or if they say, we follow Yahweh, then they're going to offend Ahab, who might kill them or do something untoward to them. So they were continuing to waver between two opinions. They just weren't going to say anything. They weren't going to take a stand. So we go down to 1 Kings 18, verses 22 through 25. Then Elijah said to them, I am the only one of the Lord's prophets left, but Baal has 450 prophets. Get two bulls for us. Let them choose one for themselves, and let them cut it into pieces and put it on the wood, but not set fire to it. I will prepare the other bull and put it on the wood, but not set fire to it. Then you call on the name of your God, and I will call on the name of the Lord, Yahweh. The God who answers by fire, he is God. The little g God who answers by fire, he is capital G God. Then all the people said, what you say is good. Elijah said to the prophets of Baal, choose one of the bulls and prepare it first, since there are so many of you. Call on the name of your God, but do not light the fire. Now, verse 22, Elijah says, I am the only one of the Lord's prophets yet. Well, you remember that Obadiah, when he met Elijah in the wilderness on the way to Samaria, Obadiah said he had saved 100 prophets of Yahweh, 50 in one cave and 50 in another. But what Elijah is saying here, he's the only one that's publicly speaking now. And what he's trying to do is to set up the odds. He said, look here, I got one, but Baal has 450 prophets, he says in verse 22. 450 to 1. Yahweh had him, had those pagan prophets right where he wanted them. 450 to 1 odds. Now, Gill says that Elijah might have figured those other 100 prophets who were hiding in caves had already been caught and killed. Maybe. But I think, as I said earlier, and as Poole agrees with me, Elijah's referring to the fact that he's the only one present and in action in Ahab's presence. It's 450 to 1. Elijah's pointing out the severe handicap he was operating under just to make the miracle seem even bigger when Yahweh beats the prophets of Baal. Now in verse 23, Elijah tells Ahab to get two bulls. Well, that's logical. Elijah doesn't have the money for two bulls. They're expensive. He wouldn't have two bulls. He's been walking through the wilderness from Zarephath on down to Carmel. And so it would be logical for Ahab to get those two bulls. Now in verse 24, Elijah sets up the contest, the God who answers by fire. Well, that's reasonable because Baal is a fire god or sun god. Baal was a god who was supposed to control fire. Now, not everybody says that's the reason why Elijah got fire. That view is not universal, but it is a possibility. Adam Clark says this, quote, "The Baal who was worshipped here was incontestably Apollo, or the sun. He was therefore the god of fire and had only to work in his own element." So in other words, Elijah is giving the bad guys all the advantages. He says, okay, Baal's a fire god, he's a sun god, he controls fire. Well, we'll let him bring his fire down and burn up the sacrifices. And plus, you got 450 people praying, I've only got one. He's not finished with this stage setting yet either, as we'll see in just a minute. Well, when Elijah proposed the contest, the fire contest, all the people said, what you say is good. Well, don't people love a contest, don't they? A public contest. Yes, this is going to be exciting. Now, the people liked it, but also the prophets of Baal consented to the contest. That's not stated explicitly, but from the later events in the narrative, we'll see that they consented to the contest. Now, why did they do that? Well, I think there's some possibilities as to why they did it. Before Elijah separated the two bulls out, the prophets of Baal might have thought that the two bulls would stand together so that if fire did fall from heaven, it would be ambiguous as to who won the God contest. So they could cover their rear ends. Well, yeah, you prayed to Yahweh for the fire to come, but actually Yahweh's fire also burned up not only Yahweh's bull, but Baal's bull. So how can you really say that Yahweh won? Well, that's an interesting speculation. Perhaps the prophets of Baal thought that Elijah was acting extra legally. Elijah's offering sacrifices outside the temple. So they figured God wouldn't answer Elijah. So they said, okay, we'll get into this contest. God's not going to answer you, Elijah. You're not answering legally. You're not behaving legally. I doubt that very seriously that they even thought that, but that's been speculated by a commentator. Here's the real reason, in my humble opinion, why they consented to this contest of the gods. It's out of necessity. The people had already approved the contest. They had said it was good. And if the prophets had refused, maybe the people might have gotten angry at the prophets. Maybe they would even stone the prophets. What's the matter with you people? We got a contest with gods here. We don't have any water. We're dying of famine. Maybe when we find out who the true God is, we can ask him to make it rain around here. Verse 25, Elijah continues setting up the degree of difficulty for himself. He says, I tell you what, you Baal prophets, you go first. You prepare it first, since there are so many of you. You got a lot of people available to take these bulls and sacrifice the bulls and spread the pieces out and lay the wood under the bulls. Call on the name of your God, but do not light the fire. Now, why would Elijah ask the prophets of Baal to go first? Well, to give them every advantage. If fire fell for Baal first, the contest would be over. There would be no bottom half of the ninth for Jehovah, for Yahweh, to come from behind. So we continue now in 1 Kings 18, verses 26 through 29. So they took the bull given them, the prophets of Baal, the 450 prophets, took the bull given them and prepared it. Then they called on the name of Baal from morning till noon. O Baal, answer us, they shouted, but there was no response. No one answered, and they danced around the altar they had made. At noon, Elijah began to taunt them. Shout louder, he said. Surely he is a god. Surely Baal's a god. Perhaps he is deep in thought, or busy, or traveling. Maybe he is sleeping and must be awakened. Now, for all of you who think that satire is not appropriate for men of God, this is first-rate satire. It's great satire. I say that because I used some satire on some heretics, some hyper-preterist heretics one time, and I could not believe all the emails I got. How can you be a Christian and use satire? I said, my gosh, satire is used everywhere in the Bible when it's aimed at the proper people, and the prophets of Baal were perfect people to aim satire at. So in verse 28, they, the prophets of Baal, shouted louder and slashed themselves with swords and spears, as was their custom, until their blood flowed. Midday passed, and they continued their frantic prophesying until the time for the evening sacrifice. But there was no response. No one answered. No one paid attention. Well, from morning to noon, when they got up to noon, the sun's at its strongest. Baal's the sun god. That'd be the proper time for Baal to put some fire down there on the altar. He didn't. Then they started dancing around the altar. Now, what does this mean? Well, it could be dancing was the way they customarily did their sacred services to Baal. Could be they're agitated by a prophetic fury and frenzy. And this is typical, just like Dionysian orgies and frenzies where the people that worship the god go nuts, which is the way that people possessed by demons do, because demons are furious. They're in a frenzy. They show lack of reason, lack of peace. Adam Clark says that these prophets of Baal, quote, danced around the altar with strange and hideous cries and gesticulations, tossing their heads to and fro with a great variety of bodily contortions. And so I think that's what the dancing was. This is not ballet they're doing. It's demonic herky-jerky type stuff. Verse 27, at noon Elijah began to taunt them. Oh, a man of God actually taunting somebody? Yes. And considering his circumstances, that was a pretty brave thing to do. He's surrounded by prophets of Baal. He's surrounded by Ahab and his retainers, who are, of course, opposed to Elijah. And Ahab had spent the last 3.5 years looking for Elijah so he could kill him. But Elijah's bold. He knows God's behind him. So he starts to make fun of Ahab's prophets of Baal. Shout louder. Maybe he's sleeping and must be awakened. Pagans used to fear to go into the temples of their gods at noon because the gods used to sleep at noon, according to John Gill. And so Elijah could be right here making fun of that. It's noontime. Your god's taking a nap. Maybe you better wake him up. Adam Clark says it's not sleeping that they're doing, that Elijah says they're doing, that, but they actually go into the privy, to the WC, to the water closet, to the WC, to the John. I wish that the translations had translated it that way, because that really would be making fun of these stupid Baal gods, or Baal God, I should say, or these stupid Baal prophets. Well, the response to that was they started shouting louder, slash themselves with swords. Why would they slash themselves with a sword? Well, this is a very common custom among the heathen. Perhaps they thought if the blood of bullocks wouldn't move Baal, perhaps human blood would. Their own blood might get Baal to send some fire down, burn up this bull. Well, they kept it up until evening. That's a long time. Frantic prophesying until time for the evening sacrifice. That's usually in the late afternoon. Maybe I think it's about 5 o'clock or so. So this is hours, all the way from morning to late afternoon, the evening, dancing, shrieking, contorting, prophesying. Hey, Baal, we say that you're God. Nothing happened. There was no response. Now, I want to hear, why didn't Satan try lying signs and wonders here? I mean, the devil can do that. Well, but he doesn't have as much power as God. You got Elijah there. He's got Yahweh behind him. The devil might have been scared to do anything. Or it could be that Yahweh just restrained the devil, tied his hands, and said, you're not going to do anything here. That's my speculation. We turn now to 1 Kings chapter 18, verses 30 through 35. Then Elijah said to all the people, come here to me. They came to him, and he repaired the altar of the Lord, which was in ruins. Elijah took 12 stones, one for each of the tribes descended from Jacob, to whom the word of the Lord had come, saying, your name shall be Israel. With the stones he built an altar in the name of the Lord, and he dug a trench around it large enough to hold 2 seahs of seed. Holman Christian Study Bible has 4 gallons. NIV has 2 seahs of seed. That's a Hebrew measurement, seah. He arranged the wood, cut the bull into pieces, and laid it on the wood. Then he said to them, fill 4 large jars with water and pour it on the offering and on the wood. Do it again, he said, and they did it again. Do it a third time, he ordered, and they did it the third time. The water ran down the altar and even filled the trench. Now this altar of the Lord that Elijah's working with him, that he repaired, that was probably one of the altars on the high place that people were using to sacrifice to Yahweh. Not a pagan altar, but a Yahweh altar. Of course, these high places are famous, of course. These are the same high places that Asa did not pull down, even after the Solomon's temple was built. Here's what Gill says about this altar of the Lord, quote, which had been set up when high places and altars were allowed of, while the tabernacle was unsettled and the temple not built. This is supposed to have been erected in the time of the judges. And, of course, that was a good while ago. The judges were from the 1300s, the 1200s, and the 1100s. In that period, and now we are in the 800s, namely 874 to 853 during Ahab's reign. So these altars could have been a couple hundred years old, 200 or 300 years old. So Elijah took the old altar. He took 12 stones, one for each of the tribes descended from Jacob. Why did he do the 12 stones? Because he's trying to say, look, Israel ought to be united. We're here with 10 northern tribes, but it should be 12 tribes. Yahweh is the God of 12 tribes, and you, Ahab, are in charge of a rump kingdom that has, in an ungodly fashion, disassociated itself with your fellow tribesmen. So that's the point of the 12 stones. Now I'm going to take us on a little rabbit trail here. 12 tribes was mentioned by Elijah. or the 12 stones was mentioned by Elijah, which of course stood for the 12 tribes. We often talk about the 12 tribes of Israel, and then we talk about the 10 northern tribes. That's standard nomenclature. But if you sit down like I did and start trying to name those tribes, we run into some problems. Well, let's see how Wikipedia lists the 10 northern tribes. Reuben, 1. Simeon, 2. Dan, 3. Naphtali, 4. Gad, 5. Asher, 6. Issachar, 7. Zebulun, 8. Manasseh, 9. And Ephraim, 10. No problem. Well, except this. Two problems. Levi's not counted. Okay, well, we won't count Levi because they didn't have land allotted to them, and the 12 tribes refers to tribes that have land allotted to them. Okay, I can go with that. But how about this? Simeon is listed as one of the 10 lost northern tribes of Israel. And I've looked at several websites, and they always list Simeon. Well, how is that? Because Simeon is not a northern tribe. Its territory was scattered all through the tribe of Judah. And Judah's in the south, not the north. Well, here's some options to answer that problem, or one option to answer that problem. Some Simeonites relocated in the north. The tribe of Simeon was assimilated into Judah because it didn't have contiguous territory, and pretty soon it just disappeared, and some Simeonites headed north and became part of the northern 10 tribes. I found this solution on a website called www.mundomayfoundation. Now, these people might be nuts, as I don't know who these people are, but this is their idea. In time, part of the tribe of Simeon was apparently absorbed by Judah, while other members possibly relocated in the north. One way or another, the tribe of Simeon disappeared from history and is thus numbered among the 10 lost tribes of Israel. Now, Wikipedia disagrees with that and says this, quote, "It is usually counted, Simeon is usually counted as one of the 10 lost tribes, but as its territory was south of Judah and gradually being absorbed by Judah, it cannot be considered one of the tribes of the kingdom of Israel." Well, if that's true, that doesn't mean the Bible's wrong, because the Bible doesn't call it the 10 tribes. That's just what we call it. That's what people call it, the 10 tribes of Israel. Well, who are the southern two tribes? That's Judah and Benjamin. That's easy. You don't count Levi, even though the Levites were run out of the northern tribe by Jeroboam, and they ran on down to Judah, down to the south. And so you don't have a problem there, and you assume that Simeon has disappeared from Judah. Interesting little rabbit trail, I thought. Elijah mentions that each stone stands for a tribe descended from Jacob. Then he says, Jacob had the word of the Lord come to Jacob, saying, "Your name shall be Israel." But Jacob means supplanter. Israel means the one who struggles with God. Remember, Jacob wrestled with God at the Yabbok River near Peniel on the east side of the Jordan. And so Elijah appeals to that little bit of Old Testament history and said, look at here. Israel was named after Israel, the man who struggled with God, the man who's actually seen God face to face. And who are you guys with your two golden bulls? That's kind of what he's getting at. He's appealing to history here, divine history. Elijah actually refers to a scripture. He says, Jacob, to whom the word of the Lord had come, saying, quote, "Your name shall be Israel." That is from Genesis 32:28. "Your name will no longer be Jacob," he said. "It will be Israel, because you have struggled with God and with men and have prevailed." Now, of course, one who struggles with God has power with God, as Jacob said. And the idea here is Elijah can struggle with God and ask God for things too, because he's that close to the Yahweh of Israel. So Yahweh builds the altar. He digs a trench around it, large enough to hold two seahs of seed. That's the NIV. The Holman Christian Study Bible says large enough to hold 4 gallons. The NIV says it's about 13 quarts. It's not quite the same as 4 gallons, but you got the idea. Now, that water must have been precious. Remember, they were in a drought. John Gill says they could have gotten the water from the sea, but as that commentator I just read to you just recently, it's a long way to the sea, the Mediterranean Sea, to bring the water. They probably got it from a nearby spring. Now you say, well, what is this idea of seeds being in the trench? It's actually large enough to hold two seahs of seed. It doesn't say that the two seeds were actually put into the trench. And actually, the NIV is using the Septuagint translation that has seed there. The Masoretic doesn't have seed. It just says it's big enough to hold 4 gallons, full stop, period. At any rate, what is the point of having water in a trench around the altar? Well, that's to make the miracles appear even bigger, because water puts things out. And Elijah's getting ready to ask fire to come down to light up the sacrifice. So the trench was put there to show that there was no way that any natural means were going to be used by Elijah in order to light the altar. Elijah wanted to allay suspicion that there might have been fire concealed under the altar. Now, to show you how fraudulent pagan priests might do that, let me quote from Adam Clark. Quote, an ancient writer says that he had seen under the altars of the heathens holes dug in the earth with funnels proceeding from them and communicating with openings on the tops of the altars. In the former, the holes, the priest concealed fire, which, communicating through the funnels with the holes, set fire to the wood and consumed the sacrifice, and thus the simple people were led to believe that the sacrifice was consumed by a miraculous fire. Well, if that had been done back then, Elijah wants to make sure that nobody thinks that, so that's why he put the water around the altar, because if there's water there, you couldn't have any secret fire under the altar sending fire up through a hole, through a funnel, up to the sacrifice. So we go down to 1 Kings 18, verses 36 through 39. At the time of sacrifice, the prophet Elijah stepped forward and prayed, O Lord, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, let it be known today that you are God in Israel, and that I am your servant, and have done all these things at your command. Answer me, O Lord, answer me, so these people will know that you, O Lord, are God, and that you are turning their hearts back again. Notice how Elijah is concerned about repentance. He's not just concerned about winning an idol contest, a God contest. He is interested in getting the people to repent, because that's what prophets do. Verse 38. Then the fire of the Lord fell and burned up the sacrifice, the wood, the stones, and the soil, and also licked up the water in the trench. When all the people saw this, they fell prostrate and cried, The Lord, He is God, the Lord, He is God. So at the time of sacrifice, we've already gotten to the evening from previous reference there to how long these pagan prophets were prophesying in a frenzy. The time of the sacrifice, KGV says the evening sacrifice, the late afternoon. So Elijah had had enough. He gave the prophets of Baal enough time to make fools out of themselves. And then he's going to say, okay, I'm going to show how it's done. I'm going to show you guys how God lights altars up with fire. He says, let it be known today that you're God. Well, you would think that Elijah, having already made it not rain for 3.5 years, the people would know God was God. You would think they would not need to have recourse to a fire from the sky in a contest, but people are hard-hearted and stubborn, so they're really going to get shown who's the boss God here. He also says not only let it be known that God is God, but also that Elijah is God's servant, and that he's done all these things at God's command. And so then he says in verse 37, answer me, and of course what he means is, send fire down. That's what the contest is. Verse 38, then the fire of the Lord fell and burned up the sacrifice, the wood, the stones, and the soil. Now let me read you what Clark says about this fire. The process of this consumption is very remarkable and all calculated to remove the possibility of a suspicion that there was any concealed fire. Number one, the fire came down from heaven. Could have come up from below in a hidden cavity somewhere. Number two, the pieces of the sacrifice were first consumed. That means the fire is coming from above, not from below. Three, the wood next, to show that it was not even by means of the wood that the flesh was burned. Well, that would be obvious anyway, because the wood wasn't burning. Number four, the 12 stones were also consumed, to show that it was no common fire, but one whose agency nothing could resist. Number five, the dust, the earth of which the altar was constructed, was burned up. Six, the water that was in the trench was, by the action of this fire, entirely evaporated. Seven, the action of this fire was in every case downward, contrary to the nature of all earthly and material fire. Well, I don't know if Clark is exactly right about this, because I think this was lightning. Fire can often be translated as lightning. And lightning does come from up to down, in which so it would be a normal, natural progression of the direction of the fire, the lightning. Now, of course, the miracle in that case would not be lightning, because lightning is not miraculous, but it's the timing of the lightning, the place of the lightning. I mean, it comes down from heaven right when Elijah prays, and it hits a specific spot, the altar. So there's your miracle, if I'm right about fire being lightning. Now, one reason why I want to say that fire and lightning is because of this little detail in verse 38. It says the stones and the soil will burn up. Stones and soil? How do stones burn? How does soil burn? Well, I looked up on the internet to get some scientific corroboration of this. This is from spectrumlocalnews.com. This is not very scientific. It's a news channel, but The author says this, quote, with up to a billion volts of electricity, lightning burns at 50,000 degrees, making it hotter than the surface of the sun. Well, that would burn anything up, stones as well as soil. But then I found something even more interesting. This is from a website called physicsworld.com. Quote, researchers in China are the first to study ball lightning using high-resolution spectroscopy. Their results lend support to an idea first advanced in the year 2000 that ball lightning is fueled by burning minerals from soil. Now, this ball lightning that's being referred to here has not been seen by too many people. I must say that I'm one of those few people because I happen to see it because where I live out in the country, I live on the top of a hill that seems to be a sump for lightning. Lightning loves to strike out here. I've never seen so much lightning. One day there was a huge lightning storm. I'm looking out the back of my house watching this lightning storm because it was really quite an impressive thing to see. And all of a sudden there was this crack and this shimmering, wavering ball about 6, 7, 8, maybe 8 or 9 or 10 inches in diameter, proceeds from in the middle of the air, comes from towards my house from the back of the house through the glass. Now this glass is skyscraper glass. It's double paned. It's got a sheet of plastic in the middle for heat insulation. This shimmering ball went right through the glass without changing shape, without changing color. It was purplish whitish color. It came into the house over my staircase. It started burning up my electrical equipment. It cost me over $1,000 to replace all the stereo equipment I had. And all that equipment, by the way, was unplugged from the wall. It started smelling of ozone in my living room. And then the purplish white ball, the ball lightning, went up my staircase, hit the wall of my bedroom at the top of the staircase, and poofed, disappeared. Now, not many people have seen this, and at the time, nobody had ever photographed it, but according to this website, some people in Qinghai, China, in the first decade of the 21st century, actually accidentally photographed some ball lightning. Let me read you this description of it from physicsworld.com. Indeed, accounts of ball lightning can vary dramatically. Most have the orb moving horizontally just above the ground at speeds of several meters per second. I can say here, here to that. That's what happened. Mine was probably a little bit slower than that, but it was in the range. Others have described balls that move either up or down. Well, the one I saw moved horizontally for a while, and then it moved up my staircase. The motion can be along either straight or meandering paths. Path was straight in my case. The balls seem to vary in size between 1 and 100 centimeters. That's about the size of my ball. They endure for about 1 to 10 seconds before vanishing. That's exactly what happened with mine. Their color can be white, orange, yellow, purple, or green. Mine was purplish white. Now, this ball lightning is said to come, if you read further into the article, from minerals in the soil being burnt up and releasing energy. So soil can burn. As physicsworld.com says, ball lightning is fueled by burning minerals from the soil. The idea is advanced. If that's the case, it's a theory still, burning minerals from the soil. So, I think that's what happened. God blasted to the altar with lightning, burn up the stones in the soil. And of course, that would evaporate the water. No problem there. Well, it was such a remarkable sight in verse 39. All the people said, whoa, the Lord Yahweh, he is God. Yahweh, he is God. A little cheering section for the true God. We go to 1 Kings 18, verse 40. Then Elijah commanded them, seize the prophets of Baal. Don't let anyone get away. They seized them, and Elijah had them brought down to the Kishon Valley and slaughtered there. That's bad when you lose a prophet's contest. I guess if Baal had won that contest, Elijah would have gotten killed too. Would have gotten killed. But he didn't. He won. And that just shows that idolatry is a capital offense. A capital offense. And Ahab just sits there and watches his prophets get murdered. He doesn't try to stop. I shouldn't say murdered. They were slaughtered. Murdered is an unjustifiable homicide. But when someone is executing the judgment of God, it's an execution, not a murder. And by the way, that just shows how important or how serious idolatry is to God. All the Old Testament, it's idolatry, idolatry, idolatry. Don't do it, don't do it, don't do it. The first commandment, you shall have no other gods before me. Don't have any graven images. Idolatry is very serious business. It's the besetting sin of mankind. It's the besetting sin of Americans in the United States of America. Americans don't actually burn animals on an altar, but they worship other things besides God, namely money, power, sex, drugs. Well, why didn't Ahab stop the seizure of all his prophets? Why didn't he stop the slaughter of all his prophets? Well, maybe he was too surprised to try to stop it. The whole situation must have been awesome. Happened all of a sudden, the people screaming and yelling, Yahweh is God, Yahweh is God. And Ahab's not going to stop that. Maybe he was too convicted to try to stop it. Adam Clark says it seems also that Ahab, who was present, consented to this act of impartial justice. He's saying, oh yeah, man, these Baal prophets, they've led me astray. They deserve to die. Or it could be that all those people shouting, Yahweh is God, there might have been so many of them that Ahab was scared to tackle them, to mess with them. And so he just let the execution go on. We go now to 1 Kings 18, verses 41 through 46, and we will finish this audio. And Elijah said to Ahab, go eat and drink, for there is the sound of a heavy rain. So Ahab went off to eat and drink, but Elijah climbed to the top of Carmel, bent down to the ground, and put his face between his knees. Go and look toward the sea, Elijah told his servant. And the servant went up and looked. There's nothing there, he said. Seven times Elijah said, go back. The seventh time the servant reported, a cloud as small as a man's hand is rising from the sea. So Elijah said, go and tell Ahab, hitch up your chariot and go down before the rain stops you. Meanwhile, the sky grew black with clouds. The wind rose, a heavy rain came on, and Ahab rode off to Jezreel. Jezreel is the summer home of Ahab. The power of the Lord came upon Elijah, and tucking his cloak into his belt, he ran ahead of Ahab all the way to Jezreel. Now, why did Elijah all of a sudden at this point say, go get something to eat? Well, Ahab had no time to eat and drink all day watching this prophets contest. And Elijah is also saying to Ahab, this is a time for joy. Eat and drink because there's rain coming. You don't have to fast anymore and scrunch on your food because rain is coming. Now, what's the sound of a heavy rain? Maybe the wind began to rise. Loud claps of thunder are coming. So Ahab went off to eat and drink. Elijah goes the other way to the top of Carmel. Why did he go there? Because he could see gathering clouds better. Now remember, clouds have not come. Maybe there's some sounds, the wind's whipping up, but Elijah hasn't actually seen any clouds yet. So he goes up to the top of Carmel in verse 42. He bends down to the ground, puts his face between his knees. What he's doing here, well, he went up there so he could see the gathering clouds better. And what he did when he bent over, he was praying. James 5:18, again he prayed. Elijah prayed and the heavens gave rain and the earth produced its crops. Elijah put his face between his knees, and it doesn't say this, but he probably also put his forehead touching the ground. He's bowing down in abject humility before God. God, please make it rain. And he had to send his servant back seven times to see if God had answered the prayer. Now that's amazing. God had already told Elijah in the previous chapter, he said, you tell Ahab it's going to rain. It's not going to rain unless Elijah says it's going to rain. Well, it seems like Elijah has the imprimatur of the Lord. He's got permission to say it's going to rain or not going to rain. And yet he's got to pray seven times for God to back him up on that. Seven times. Well, to me, this is a perfect example of the need for importunate prayer. God tells you something, you know it's true, it's in the Bible. He might have even confirmed it to you by circumstances or by prophecy or however. You know it's true, and you pray, and it doesn't happen. Well, the answer, what are your choices? You can say, well, I don't believe God anymore, or I don't understand God, I'm just going to be depressed about it, or you can keep praying. Why did Jesus come up with this idea of importunate prayer at least, several times? The widow and the unjust judge, the man who's gone to bed with his daughters in the house, and the stranger comes and says, give me some bread, knock, 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 give me some bread. Leave me alone, I'm sleeping, give me some bread. Importunate prayer. That's the King James. I like that word, importunate. Persistent prayer is what it means. Keep on praying. And here Elijah prayed seven times. I need some rain, God, seven times. After the seventh time, that servant reported in verse 44, a cloud as small as a man's hand is rising from the sea. Now, when clouds rise from the sea, that means rain is coming, because that's where clouds come from, the evaporating water from the sea. Now, this cloud as small as a man's hand, that's not absolutely the size of the cloud. Cloud that small is not a cloud, that's a puff. It means from the perspective of the servant who's looking from afar off on Mount Carmel, it looks like the size of a man's hand, but of course it's going to be bigger than that. So Elijah knows the rain's coming, so he tells Ahab, get out of here before the rain stops you. Now, why would the rain stop him? Because Ahab's in a chariot, and the rain would make the roads muddy, sloppy, and he would get bogged down in the the road and wouldn't be able to get back to Jezreel, which is about 16 or so miles away down the Esdraelon Valley. There's another thing that might happen to keep Ahab getting down to Jezreel. He's going to have to get down to the valley somehow from up Mount Carmel, and not only would the roads be muddy, but the Kishon Brook is right down there too, and that's probably going to be overflowing, which could get him caught in a flash flood. If he stayed up on Mount Carmel, he'd be up there in the middle of a lightning storm. So he's got to get going. So Elijah tells him, get going. And so Ahab, in verse 45, rode off. It doesn't say how fast, but we can assume that he rode off as fast as he could go. Now in verse 46, we read, the power of the Lord came upon Elijah, and tucking his cloak into his belt, that's so he can run better, he ran ahead of Ahab all the way to Jezreel. Now Jezreel, as I said, is about 16 miles from Mount Carmel to Jezreel. That's a long way for an old man. That's why the author of our text here says the power of the Lord came upon Elijah. This was supernatural strength that Elijah had here, not natural strength, as Benson, the Methodist commentator, says. Now, the fact that he's running before Ahab, what does this show? Well, John Gill and Colin Delitzsch say that this showed that Elijah was very humble. It showed that he had no ill will to Ahab. He's willing to show him all honor and respect due him as a king because he's running before him, just like runners would run before chariots of kings to show honor. And so Ahab's doing the same thing. Elijah is doing the same thing to show honor to Ahab. So Elijah is trying to say, look, it was Ahab's sins, not his person, that Elijah had an aversion for. Basically, if you're running on foot before a chariot, you're saying, I'm on foot, you have wheels, so you are most honored, O king. Colin Delitzsch says this, quote, this act of Elijah, whom Ahab had hitherto only known as a stern, imperious, and powerful prophet, by which he now showed himself to be his faithful subject and servant, was admirably adapted to touch the heart of the king and produce the conviction that it was not from any personal dislike to him, but only in the service of the Lord, that the prophet was angry at his idolatry and that he was not trying to effect his ruin, but rather his conversion and the salvation of his soul. So Colin Delitzsch showed that Elijah is interested in conversion, not destruction. We know that also by reading 1 Kings 18:37. Elijah says this, answer me, Lord, answer me so that this people will know that you, Yahweh, are God and that you have turned their hearts back. Turn their hearts back. Elijah wants the people to repent. He's not just interested in winning a victory. Now, Adam Clark rejects this common opinion that Elijah is showing his humility by running ahead of Ahab. Clark says that Elijah is running ahead of Ahab to make Ahab respect and fear Elijah, so that Elijah would not do anything to harm so that Ahab would not do anything to harm Elijah. And perhaps it's both. At any rate, Elijah running in front of Ahab's chariot, this shows his courage. He's not afraid to go back to Jezreel, where Jezebel will be waiting for him and her 400 prophets who are not dead. 450 prophets of Baal had been killed, but not the 400 prophets of Asherah. And Elijah might have to deal with that when he got down there to Jezreel. Now, the next question we might want to ask is, how did Elijah, who was traveling on foot, beat Ahab, who's in a chariot? Well, we've already said that Elijah had supernatural power, but there's other natural reasons, too. The road's going to be muddy with all that rain. That's going to bog down a chariot. At any rate, Elijah got there first. I mentioned that it was customary for runners to run ahead in chariots. Remember, Absalom did that when he was taken over rebelling against King David. One of my commentators says this, quote, it was anciently and still is in some countries of the East customary for kings and nobles to have runners before their chariots who are tightly girt for the purpose. The runners are dressed for running, clothes tightly wound around them. That was customary. So I really think that this incident is just to show honor to Ahab, which is really nice of Elijah, considering that Ahab had been trying to kill him for 3.5 years. And so Elijah goes all the way down to Jezreel, and that ends our chapter. Let me point out on the map, if you look at Mount Carmel, which is up there near the little promontory of land that sticks out on the southern end of the Sea of Acre, the Bay of Acre, at the Mediterranean Sea. And then you look northeast and go straight down the rocky cliff, and you see the flat valley of Esdraelon and the Kishon River running through that. Well, follow the Kishon River from northwest to southeast and go about maybe 2/3 of the way to the Jordan River. That's roughly where Jezreel is. And so we'll leave us there at Jezreel as we prepare to go to our next chapter in this story of the kings of Israel. In our next audio, we'll cover 1 Kings 19, verses 1 through 21, the whole chapter. We will see Elijah fleeing from Jezebel, and we'll also see the call of Elisha. Hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.